This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, you can go to kboo.fm/radiozine. Should be on the website in the next hour or so.
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KBOO's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KBOO.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have questions, please contact Monica Beamer at monica@kboo.org. Thank you for contributing to the development of KBOO's mission and vision statements and for your support of community radio.
Now, that intro was from our engineer, Joe. We have two people that have been live in studio. What a gift. Good morning. This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland on this warm, warm summer day. A lot of us have been thinking about backyards and helping plants, wildlife, and nature kind of manage this stressful heat wave. And today we have with us in studio author Terry Messier, who knows a little bit about the subjects of wildlife under stress in backyards and beyond. Her new book, Fastest Thing on Wings, just came out. She's talking about one of our most treasured backyard visitors, hummingbirds, and her account of rescuing them. It's a passionate memoir about saving hurt and orphaned birds and about the human bond we have with animals, especially those rehabbers who save and rehabilitate them. I want you to know, when I told people that I was doing this interview today, to a person, their voice went up and everybody went, oh. I mean, it was more universal than a newborn baby.
I believe that, Michelle. I hear that every day.
I was going to say, welcome to KBOO and congratulations on your debut book.
Thank you.
It really is and has been an educational, captivating, and heartfelt book. I was unprepared and it was lovely. So I guess we should start with the first question I had when I was starting to read the book. I got answered in one sentence, the very first part very few people can relate to, the latter almost everyone can. This is a direct quote. While hydroplaning across spilled sugar water on the kitchen floor, I bribed a colleague at UCLA to take my American culture class before calling Jean back. At the time, I didn't know anything about hummingbirds, but I'd been watching the nests for weeks and was certain the baby would die if I didn't act quickly. So I again, to a person, the observing, the caring, the immediate enwrapped bond, that starts the whole story. So you talked about your love of nature and your youth in rural Wisconsin. Let's go there to give a background.
Oh, well, I grew up in the countryside on a farm, so animals were a mixed bag. You know, there was a lot of positive things, but there were a lot of hard things too. So, but I grew up, you know, living out in the forest. Essentially, I spent the summers running around the woods and, you know, watching creatures. So, and I did raise a few birds as a child, although I didn't know what I was doing, sadly. So, but it was a beginning.
Yes. And then we find that you're at UCLA. So you're an academic, and give us a little background that I think people would be unprepared for such a a shocking change in your life, as you were.
Yes, the hummingbirds kind of came in, into my life under unusual circumstances. I was teaching at UCLA. I was teaching English as a second language to international graduate students, which is a very exciting and fulfilling job. And the birds just kind of came to me completely out of the blue. I had no expectation that I would be doing this, but I had wanted to get involved in wildlife rehab my entire life. And so when it happened, it was kind of...
It found me,
yeah, and it happened twice, as you know from reading the book. The first time when my cat brought a baby into the house, and then the second time, the scene that you just read about the baby being washed out of the tree the next year, and then I found my mentor, so when the student was ready, the teacher appeared.
Absolutely. I love this description in the book about yourself. I had transitioned from that insidiously creeping midlife sense of delusionment and lack of purpose to feeling gifted and necessary. That is the whole theme in the book, and I thought it was really important in the first part that it really talked a lot about that almost egocentric, and I thought you were so great at exposing the reader. So talk a little bit about the heady first years and moments of finding and some of the actual rescues and how that went without giving too much away. It's hard because
there are a few secrets we don't want to give a spoiler alert, but teaching is a fulfilling job, but Even in teaching, unless you're doing research, you tend to be doing the same thing every day. And I love the job. But when the birds came into my life, it seized me. It grabbed my heart. And I felt like this is it. This is what I want to do. And then when I went down and saw my mentor's rehab center, I was hooked. I wanted to do it. So I started driving for her because sometimes people won't or can't bring the birds to her. And I just... for the first year, drove birds around the freeways of Los Angeles, picking them up, taking them down to the rehab center.
Yeah. And, now describe a little bit, because you do a good job in the book of describing what that looks like. I mean, they're in all kinds of states, and you usually get them little hands holding or bigger hands holding or some kind of a box or...
Early beginnings started with tree trimmers, which is a tragedy because the city trims the trees in the spring. So hundreds of birds, not just hummingbirds, but all birds get cut out of their homes. And these nests end up, you know, out of on the street or in a dumpster. It's quite horrible. So when people would call, she would send me, and I thought, wow, this is really awful, because most people couldn't find her. She was older and wasn't internet savvy. So I set up a website immediately and said, I want to make it easy for people to find me. And in fact, I did. Within a year or two, 6-year-olds could look me up on their iPhones.
And they did. As we noted in the book. Yeah.
And so now anybody can call me anytime. There's no excuse not to call. And so we're easy to locate. And in doing that, I basically moved from saving maybe 100 to 200 birds a year to saving 1,000.
Yeah. Now, let me digress for a moment, because I want to talk about numbers. And you even referenced Portland in the book. At the time, you were not a resident, and now you are. So we're glad to have you here, especially with your debut book and all that you've done. But midway through the book, you referenced Portland's rate of rehab, and it was laughable, the statistics.
It is.
Can you give us any idea of population through the West? And I think people, you know, anecdotally say, are there more of them? Are there less of them? I see them now. I didn't notice them before. Can you give us some general ideas?
There were about 5 million Anna's hummingbirds. And again, these are rough estimates because nobody really knows how many hummingbirds there are. There are 330 species, only 16 nest north of the Mexican border. So U.S.-Mexican border. So we only have probably a dozen that we see regularly in California and Oregon. California and Oregon have the same species, interestingly, because they run up and down, they fly up and down the coast. So the Anna's and Rufus are the primary species here. They nest out in the forest, and so we never see nests here. So when I went to Portland Audubon the first year I was here and said, how many birds do you rehabilitate? They said 12. And I said, no, not in a day, in a year. And they said 12. And when I called my rehabbers in LA, they cracked up. They were like, that's a Monday morning in June, you know, because everybody waits till the weekend. And so we do probably 30, 40 a year in, a day in June, and about 500 a year that run through rehab, and then 1,000 when you count the telephone rescues. So they are the same species, but Los Angeles is unique because it has birds nesting very close to houses, on wind chimes, plants that are right next to people's front doors, trees right in your yards. The hummingbirds in Portland do not do that. Right. They nest out in the woods. So we don't have the rehab volume. In LA, the hummingbirds are constantly in conflict with the humans.
Yeah, and more urbanized setting. Mm-hmm. And does it matter that it's further south as well because there's a migratory pattern? Mm-hmm. And
sure, yeah. Allen's hummingbirds, which were non-existent in Los Angeles up until the 1980s, are now the primary species in Southern California. And the reason for that is I believe the Allens and the Rufus are hybridizing. And they look similar. The females look identical. The males look a little bit different. But I believe they're hybridizing, and hence the explosion of what people think are Allens, but are in fact Rufus Allens hybrids. The Allens came over from the Channel Islands in the 1980s. I believe that rehab has contributed to their huge success in Southern California and in LA, because we release 300 or 400 healthy young adults every year, and we see these pockets in Los Angeles, and these are the places I get the telephone calls from. There are nests all over Hollywood, the San Fernando Valley in Orange County, where people 50 years ago didn't see hummingbirds. Mm-hmm. So I believe that our rehab efforts are paying off there, and it's very gratifying to know that we can actually make this work. Do we need to do this in Portland? Not yet. But there could come a day when the birds move into the city, and then they will start to need our help.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And anecdotally, friends of mine have started seeing them.
Exactly.
And started feeding them. As a matter of fact, one of the questions, again, there's some information in the book that I think are readers need to know, and I'm hoping we can get to that. But I've had people say, so only sugar and water? And I say, well, from reading the book, not only don't be doing anything beyond sugar water, but tell us that there is a protein that you as the rescuers know about and utilize. Mm-hmm. Because in reading it, I did understand that if it's only sugar water, they would starve.
Yes.
That's not enough. But to introduce anything from anyone else would also be detrimental. And of course, there's stories throughout the book. So tell us a little bit about, anecdotally, about the issues in the book, about the ants and insects. And
I think the easiest way to think about it is to just anthropomorphize in this case. If we gave a human sugar water every day for a week, what would we be like? If that's all you ate was sugar for a week, you would
moving at that rate, we'd probably do a little of that.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you weren't trying to move fast, you would be very sick and shutting down. And so we, hummingbirds like us need protein, and that's the staple of their diet, just as it is for humans. They need protein to survive. They eat 200 to 300 fruit flies per day. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have that protein, they lose weight very quickly, because they can burn off half their body weight in one day when they fly over the Gulf of Mexico. So they can go from 6 grams to 3. So they, because their metabolism is so high, they burn weight rapidly. They need a lot of protein. Sugar water is great. As long as people keep their feeders clean, we're helping them, because we're allowing them to expand their range up into the northern areas where they really didn't hang around much, like Portland. Mm-hmm. They were here, but not in the numbers they are now. My feeders are jammed, and I'm just north of Forest Park. So they're coming up here more and more. They're starting to to breed here more, and Portland will see an increasing number if we keep hanging those feeders out. And the feeders are great for them, but you got to keep them clean. And it's just a small part of their diet. If you find a hummingbird, don't give it sugar water for more than a day or two, because then it shuts down.
Yeah. Well, interesting. I finally learned that there was some value to those pesky fruit flies. I have a new appreciation.
Exactly.
Because
you
at first I did think, my heavens, why they come up when you don't want them and they're everywhere and how can I get rid of them? And now, like I said, as is always true, the more I learn, I go, oh, interesting. Yeah. Now I have a different...
Every time I see a fruit fly in the house, I smile because I know what their purpose.
Yeah.
And I know that they're serving an incredible role in the matrix and allowing these gorgeous creatures to
exist
to live.
And to live. And I tell you, like I said, up until then, it was completely unknown to me. Well, this is a totally appropriate time coming up to the 4th of July. Let me back up for a minute, because I want people to know that I am speaking with Terry Masseur about her wonderful new book, Fastest Thing on Wings, and she's in studio. Again, you talk about the individual. We get a hint of how powerful some of these encounters were when you describe in the book meeting up with the Spanish-speaking tree trimmer who had called you after rescuing two babies. Mm-hmm. And you sit with him and you said, I sat next to him, my silent companion, in your isolated bubble of compassion that requires no explanation. And again, throughout the book, you talk about these different personalities, but almost to a person. They are touched and deeply affected by having these birds in their lives.
Yeah, sure. Nearly every finder that calls me with a hummingbird has powerful emotions. Their helpless vulnerability evokes these powerful and deep emotions in people, and they make everybody cry when things go wrong. I've seen everybody cry, people you can't even imagine.
And on that note, I rarely do this, but I wonder if I could have you read right there that paragraph. Starting there.
Yes. I have seen jaded filmmakers, hard-headed corporate executives, and calloused construction workers cradling nestlings like fragile glass figurines in their Paul Bunyan hands shed serious tears over these little birds. I've seen everybody cry. I even had a crime scene investigator break down in my garage one night when her rescued fledgling died on arrival. Although she had become accustomed to wading through unspeakable horrors in gritty neighborhoods couched in the shadows of downtown Los Angeles, watching a young hummingbird fade away with the distressed beat of his tiny wings cracked her professional armor wide open.
Yeah, and that's what the book does so well, is it introduces us to the science, to the appropriate and necessary understanding of the birds, but there are so many different places when you speak so eloquently of the people that you encounter. The other thing that becomes clear is that the birds take on an individuality. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I was completely blindsided by the fact that they could even.
Yes, I think that's the thing that really blew me away when I first started doing rehab, was how each bird has an individual personality. You would think that higher mammals have personalities like elephants or great apes or chimpanzees, of course, right?
Yes.
But to see something as diminutive as a hummingbird and then learn that each one is different. Some are tough as nails and fiercely independent. Others are frightened and fragile and independent. Each one's different. Each one has a different personality. Some are more extreme than others. But you can't believe the things that affect them and their emotional reactions to things, as well as having an incredible intellectual memory about where feeders are and how to migrate and where to go. They have a very profound emotional memory as well.
Yeah. And for our readers to understand, you had, by default, converted your home with the assistance and I would say support of your husband into give us a description of your house at that particular time after 2005 and beginning in the middle of this journey.
Well, it's all outside, Michelle, because I have indoor cats.
Right.
My cats are not allowed to go outside, but they have their own little outdoor cages. And so the entire hummingbird operation is outside. The ICU or incubator for babies and nestlings is in the garage. And then there are two different sizes of flight cages. The small flight cage when they first learn to fledge and they go in there with a roommate. And then the large flight cage which they move into with other roommates to develop other skills like hovering, eating plants, catching fruit flies. And then finally the aviary, which is kind of a preparation for the real world for a release. So each one moves through there, the same educational system. And you know, you're constantly transferring them from one level to another, like school kids.
Yes. Although, again, I was completely unaware of how long this process took for some of these birds. No wonder they had individual names, right, and personalities and characteristics, because they were part of your daily existence, if not hourly at some points in time.
Oh, sure. Like the brown sugar twins.
Yeah.
They were beautiful birds and who were nearly killed by a well-meaning but misguided finder who cut their nest. Their mother wasn't even gone, but he didn't realize that at one week of age, the mother stopped sitting on the nest. Before I set up my website, hundreds of birds were destroyed this way by well-meaning finders.
Because they thought that the mother had abandoned them.
Exactly.
And also the myth in the book that if you touch them,
exactly,
then the mother will never come back.
Right.
There was a lot of that. So first of all, tell just a little bit about why they were named the brown sugar twins.
The brown sugar twins were found.
Yeah.
They were brought in by a young Japanese corporate executive who had never seen hummingbirds before. He was from Tokyo.
Yeah.
And of course, everyone loves hummingbirds. They're gorgeous.
And I just need to interrupt here. I did not understand that they were federally protected, and right, this was an interesting point. So continue on.
They are protected under the same law as bald eagles.
Yeah.
So a lot of people believe that they can, you know, bring
domesticate
hummingbirds
or have
them,
yeah,
because they're so little. What does it matter? But it's the same law as that protects the bald eagles, the migratory.
So anyway, this gentleman didn't clearly know the law.
Well, he didn't know anything.
And he didn't do it intentionally.
One morning he got up, the mother was gone. But that's what happens at 8 to 10 days. She no longer sits on the nest to reduce predation. The only problem is it attracts human attention, and people have terrified responses to this, the fact that she's suddenly gone. She's not sitting there anymore. So he cut the nest, brought them in, kept them for a week on brown sugar, which they don't eat brown sugar anyway.
Yeah, tell them what happens. Their throat.
They have a crop on the right side of their neck that's like a little sack where they store food, and it was gummed up. So I had to siphon it off. First, I had to put warm water in them and siphon them off. And I did manage to save them. But by the time I got them, they were cold as ice and about an hour from death.
Now, also, I learned a word, and both my sons knew it, and, you know, far more. Torpor.
Oh, torpor. Torpor is a really fascinating evolutionary marvel in which birds can reduce their metabolism to 5% of its normal capacity when they're injured or they need to conserve heat.
Yeah, exactly as you said when you were sick in the book with your own malady. Exactly.
They can check out.
Yeah, that you would, all the reserve goes in and they just shut down. Mm-hmm. But to the naked eye, it looks like they're dead.
They look dead, and they look almost dead. And in fact, sometimes when you find them on a perch in the morning, some are,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
in rehab, and they just went to sleep and
passed.
Didn't wake up.
Yeah,
which is an easy way to die. It's fine. It's nature's way. It's very soft. It's a natural sedative.
Yeah,
but it's necessary for birds that live in colder climates, such as the mountains in South America. They go into torpor every night in order to conserve heat because they're in very cold climates. So they can do that, and then they wake up in the morning. Our little hummingbirds in Southern California don't need to go into torpor, but they do if they're injured or they're starving.
Yeah, because they would. wouldn't need to against the elements as much as the predation or accidents around them that Correct. Could happen. Yeah. So I learned some wonderful things. Well, again, this is I'm speaking with Terry Messer about her new book, Fastest Things on Wings, about rescuing and her whole experience with that. I can imagine, and I was thinking about this as 4th of July is coming, and I was in the book, the frenetic and overwhelming pace that starts in June, where the rest of it, I was thinking, oh, you know, a professor and then summer and, well, not really. So talk to us about June and July and about the nesting and breeding and amplification of everything.
Well, May and June are the months in which we get the most rescues because the babies are fledging. And a lot of people mistakenly believe when they find a baby on the ground that it's been abandoned, so they take it home. And then the mother can no longer, the bond is broken.
Provide,
the mother can't feed it anymore. So it's good that we have the website now because people can call me from that site.
Please, and this would be an opportune time to talk about that too.
Yeah. They call me from right there. I'm standing on the corner of, you know, 3rd and, you know, something, and I, you know, there's a baby here, so I have them build a little faux nest with a little container and some Kleenex, and we just you know, secure that nest up in the tree right above where the baby is because it fell straight down. So, you know, we want to keep the birds out in their natural environment. We don't want more babies in rehab. We're going nuts already. So it's good that people can, you know, find us right away. May and June, we get 20, 30 babies a day sometimes. A lot of tree trimming victims. Unfortunately, many of those can't be put back because the tree is gone. But then around the 4th of July, things taper off. It's really the end. This weekend, it's over after this. There will just be a trickle after this. But we can't do any releases, as you read, because the fireworks, if fireworks are, you know, shoot off too close to perches, it sometimes scares them off their perch at night.
Yeah.
Just like with the domestic pets.
This is a time when most of nature would say, what are you doing?
Well, yeah, this is crazy. Everything should be calm. It's midsummer. The breeding season's over. It's time to relax. Right? Instead, we're out there, you know,
blowing
ourselves up and blowing everything up.
I tell you. Quickly, I don't even think we're going to have an opportunity to get into some of the personalities, I think that it was important in the book that you talked about the ducklings, and I like that you said, and this is a quote, but my anxious night with the ducklings reminds me how easily the tables can turn and how quickly I can be thrown out of my comfort zone when confronted with wildlife whose needs are entirely unknown to me. That made me feel better because, again, most of the people that you reference in the book were good-hearted, thoughtful, caring, you know, people that just were misguided and fearful then that they had done the wrong thing.
Correct.
And the cautionary tale through the entire book is to get in touch with somebody who actually knows, because it's easy to do the wrong thing. I think about the person who fed them ants, which of course in your mind, insects, protein, you know, doesn't that make sense? And it was almost fatal.
Yeah, it was fatal, actually.
Oh, that's right.
And unfortunately, although I didn't say it in the book, that person was warned prior to bringing the bird the day before not to give it, and still.
You know,
some people don't listen. They think because they want to entertain their children, you know, which is a terrible thing when the wildlife, its life is in
danger.
Danger. So she was warned, and that's why I became so angry, because, you know, I spoke to her the day before that. I don't say that in the book, and perhaps I should have, but most people are really, really well-meaning, and they love these little creatures, and they want to do the right thing for them, and they just don't know. And the ducks were a good opportunity for a reality check.
For you, who's an expert in that field,
right,
and sometimes forget get how it feels to be that.
Right. Toward the end of the season, you get impatient with people that say, oh, can I pick it up? You know, can I touch it?
And you know, can I keep it? God, can I have it in my cage?
And you just get impatient. You're like, come on, it's a 4 gram. Is it going to attack me? Am I going to die? Yeah. You know, so the ducks were a great reminder to me that it's easy for you to get thrown into a situation where you don't know what you're doing.
Well, I want to say that you do a great job of telling us about what you set out to do and how you feel. There's, again, a quote in the book, because what most callers really want is someone to listen to their concerns and fears and reassure them that making an effort to save something as diminutive as a hummingbird is not crazy, silly, or irrelevant. And by encouraging rather than dismissing the moment of compassion, I hope that I'm helping people develop and evolve a more empathetic consciousness that spills over into their interactions with all living things, including fellow human beings.
I love that you picked that paragraph. That I think that is my favorite paragraph in the book.
I couldn't agree more. So we only have 1 minute left. I do want people to know that they have resources, that they can go if they ever need to. And the Audubon Society, places to call, is their website that...
Sure. Yeah, I have a website, losangeleshummingbirdrescue.org. But, and the other thing I wanted to say was rehabilitation of wildlife is a really fast-growing field. There's now a national rehabilitation conference where people do everything imaginable. Every kind of bird, possums, you know, raccoons. Yeah. And so, you know...
Somehow I think you picked the one who has the most heart.
I have the like cutest I said, one, the prettiest one, this probably.
So I want to thank you again, our guest, Terry Masseur, Fastest Thing on Wings, lovely new book. Thanks for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM.
And now, the KBOO News at noon for June 29th, 2015. In local news, the Board of Directors of the Multnomah Education Service District voted unanimously to approve two unrelated separation agreements totaling more than $305,000. In order to avoid a lawsuit, the Education District paid former Superintendent Barbara Jorgensen more than $166,000. The second separation agreement involves special ed teacher Brett Bingham, Oregon's 2014 Teacher of the Year. The district paid Bingham $140,000 to avoid a lawsuit over alleged sexual discrimination by the district towards Bingham. In national news, on Saturday morning, 30-year-old activist Bree Newsom climbed the flagpole in front of the South Carolina Capitol and removed the Confederate flag that was flying. Newsom and another activist were arrested on misdemeanor charges of defacing a state monument. The Confederate flag was raised shortly thereafter by South Carolina state officials. The United States Supreme Court today voted 5-4 along party lines to halt further implementation of the Obama administration's 2011 regulation